Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Whatever your next move might be in 2017, tackle it with Squarespace. You might need a landing page, a professional blog, or an online store. If so, start your free trial today at squarespace.com. Use the offer code CanadaLand. You'll get 10% off. So there's this guy, and you'd think that he and I might be friends. Some people even think that we look alike, like I was mistaken for him at a party once, and we have similar interests and similar activities and projects. The first time I ever saw him, he was on stage hosting like a talk show, this lecture series called Trampoline Hall. It's been around for 15 years. And he was a really good host, like very quick on his feet, affable, funny. Here's a clip, actually, of how he handles the Q&A part of a Trampoline Hall lecture.
I'll ask you, sir. Yeah, oh, you, sir. I'm sorry, but you're a lady, I think. It's a dark over there. Whatever you are, dark figure over there.
Have you ever tried to reach out to Bob Saget as his lost daughter?
Have you ever tried to reach out to Bob Saget as his lost daughter?
No.
No? And why not?
I feel like if I were to do that, I would probably do it with my biological father and not Bob Saget.
Where did you, now, when you say you don't have a father, obviously at some level you have a father, like someone. But is he? So he's. I take it he's alive. Is that right?
As far as I know, I was conceived on Halloween, so it was a costume party.
Oh my god! Really? Oh my god!
Yeah.
What was? Can I ask what he was dressed as?
He was Zorro. And my mom was a nun in a full habit.
Oh my god, that's the dirtiest thing I've ever heard.
So it just seemed like we should hang out, like we were meant to be friends. And so I asked him out for a drink, like a man-friend-date kind of thing. And we did have a lot in common. We had like too much in common. Like we got to talking and it turned out that when he was in school, when he was younger, he had published some sort of subversive underground student newspaper and got in trouble with the administration. And I did that too in high school. Now, you might think that that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship between two like-minded people. But the truth is, we never hung out again. At the end of that night, I kind of shook hands with the guy. And I think that there was like a mutual recognition that this was just too weird. It was too strange and it couldn't happen. And I've taken notice of his accomplishments. His name pops up and pops up in like the Paris Review, the New Yorker. Trampoline Hall was touring in the States, or he co-wrote a book with our mutual friend called The Chairs Are Where the People Go. And it was internationally lauded. So I've like followed this guy's career, his interests. I admire his work, but we never get too close. It's kind of like on The Simpsons where there's that sort of like bizarro world Bart and Lisa from Shelbyville, who look just like Bart and Lisa, but a little bit different. And they just sort of eye each other warily and they keep going on their separate ways. A couple weeks ago, I found out that Trampoline Hall, this lecture series that Misha's been hosting for 15 years, is being turned into a podcast. And I'm thinking it's time for me to talk to Misha Globerman again. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Nathan Vexler, Stephen Butler, Derek Smith, Ryan Wahlberg, Alex Taylor, Rob Paragudoff, Shannon Alberta, and Josh Patlick. Josh, why did you decide to be awesome?
Because you and your team give me a glimpse into the sausage factory that is the Canadian media.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They're not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer. And it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
Yeah.
And this episode is brought to you by Squarespace. It is the beginning of a new year. Many of you may have resolved to take on a new challenge, start a new business, change careers, launch creative projects. Whatever your next move might be, tackle it with Squarespace. All kinds of people use Squarespace: musicians, designers, artists, restaurants. It gives you the ability to create an online platform from which to make your next move known to the world. So, whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, all of that is included in your Squarespace website. They are constantly improving their platform. You never have to install, patch, or upgrade anything. Their service is stellar 24/7. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and use the offer code CanadaLand. You will get 10% off of your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website. This episode is also brought to you by the founding sponsor of CanadaLand, FreshBooks, makers of ridiculously easy-to-use and ridiculously powerful accounting software for small businesses, freelancers, people like you and me. Check out the all-new FreshBooks. You will be amazed at how it gets you organized and gets you paid quicker. If you are billing people for anything, for any purpose whatsoever, there are tools here that will make your life easier and get you back to doing the thing that you need to do. 97% of small businesses recommend FreshBooks. Canada Land is one of them. Check it out. Go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand, where you will find a lovely picture of two young professionals working on a project. Use it for free for 30 days. When you become a customer, tell them that Canada Land sent you. You will be doing this show a favor. When I told Aaliyah that I was interviewing you,
yeah,
she said, oh, you should enjoy that. You're essentially interviewing yourself.
Yeah.
I think we all just look alike to her. I don't see it at all.
I know, in the grand scheme. Do you really not see it?
Okay, we're like...
Like, I don't think our eyes are similarly set or we have the same shape nose or we have the same shape mouth or anything.
Yeah.
But we are like, you know, we are both men of like approximately the same age, of approximately the same height and build, of approximately the same like complexion. So just like physically,
sure,
we're like pretty similar looking. And then also even in terms of sensibility, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think we're like that wildly different from each other. Like,
large bearded Jewish men of downtown, western downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
Vaguely associated with cultural circles of journalistic, literary, I don't know.
Yeah. And in ways that aren't that like different from each other, even in terms, we're also like both like interviewers, you know, like we're also both like, even the work that we do, the work that you do is in the grand scheme of things, not so different from the work that I do, you know? And then even among people who do that work, like, I like the work you do. Like when I hear Jesse, like, I'm like, oh, like, that thing Jesse said, that made sense to me. Whereas, like, there are other people who are journalists, they say things, and I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me. So I think we also are like, you know, we're not that dissimilar.
And I admire your work, so it's going to be a labor to make this not an unbearable conversation.
Well, a lot of the people who worked on Trampoline Hall, when I told them we were doing our show, they were hoping that it was going to be, like a big, like an investigation, that you'd like get to the bottom of like the Trampoline Hall scandal.
Oh, you know? Cool. That is there one?
Not that I know of, but...
It's a misnomer. I don't know. It's a false characterization to say, oh, here with me now is he's a host of this lecture series. I mean, it's true.
Yeah, it's true. It's literally true, but it's not a good bio for me in terms of who I am. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, increasingly, the thing that I spend most of my time doing and that I like doing the most and that I personally most want people to know about is the work that I do helping people learn to communicate better. So that's like, so for me, I'm like, you know, I teach these courses called How to Talk to People About Things. And that's kind of the thing. That's the thing that I do that I most, that most draws my interest and passion and excitement these days. So that's kind of part of what I do.
Yeah.
And so, you
know. It's a vague, difficult thing to, he's a guy, like, okay, so you're speaking agency bio, and I wouldn't necessarily want to, we have kind of different bios for different purposes.
Yep.
But you're described as an expert in communication and conflict resolution.
Yeah. And I would even skip the conflict resolution. I mean, yeah, and communication, like how people can understand each other better, make decisions better together.
See, this is a point of differentiation between you and I. I'm an expert in conflict creation.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what, so you put us in a room together, we just neutralize. It just comes out as just water.
The 15 years of this lecture series, it almost predates this kind of mania for lecture series.
Yeah,
it does. Maybe it
I
does.
Didn't even know there was a mania for lecture series. That's
well,
how
the
long
whole
I've been
TED
doing it.
Moth.
Yeah, it predates TED Talks was like a thing in California that maybe you heard about if you read Wired magazine. I don't know where it fits in terms of the moth, but it was certainly before anybody, you know, before anyone outside of New York would have heard about the moth, I don't think.
Yeah, and then there were like the Little Gray Book lectures that
John
Hodgman was doing.
It was exactly the same time as Little Gray Books. We started, I think, exactly this, more or less, like, I think within a month of each other was my perception, independently of each other.
15 years of lectures, you've had a lot of different kinds of people delivering lectures.
Yeah.
But is this like a hipster thing? Would you like bristle if somebody was like, you know...
I mean, you know, would I bristle? No. I mean, would some of the hipsters who come bristle? I guess. Our audience is less that audience than it was when it started. So when it started, it was sort of like people who are really close to the literary scene and art scene and music scene. I guess music scene, you know, I guess music and arts being kind of the hipster genres. And it was younger. And as it's gone on, it's become more of a mainstream audience and more of a diverse audience and more of a varied audience in that kind of way.
The disclosure that probably should have preceded all this is that I did one.
Yeah, we should talk about that. That was something I wanted to talk about at some point.
If you want to.
Yeah, maybe at some point we should talk about it. Maybe after we've talked about this. I was curious what it was like for you.
I think that the part of it that I think is like most of an achievement is just the longevity of it.
Yeah.
You got this conceit. Okay, they're talking about things that they're not an expert about, which, I don't know, maybe you can talk a little bit about the purpose of that conceit. It seems to almost be kind of forcing, like, don't take this too seriously. This is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Does it have more of like a practical function? And does that have anything to do with why it's worked for so long?
So the premise of the show, the central premise of the show is three people give lectures on subjects on which they are not professionally expert. And that doesn't mean, and sometimes people hear that and they get the impression that like it's like an improv game or something like that, but it's not. Like often people typically work very, very hard on their talks. Their talks might be about things that they know a lot about. They might be very accomplished and smart people in some cases, and in some cases they might just be like a friend of someone's mom or whatever. It could be like anybody. So it's a huge range of people in terms of expertise and stuff. I'm just going to give you the whole spiel here. So a huge range of people in terms of expertise. Some people who are really, really expert speakers. Some people who are just terrified and have never been on stage before. All that kind of stuff. But the one rule is they can't be professionally expert on the subject in which they're talking. And the function that that rule serves basically is that it transforms it. We call it a lecture series, but at some level I think what it really is it's a kind of theater. And it's a theater where the constraint is that what you can do is give a lecture. And what I guess what I mean by that distinction is, if there was a topic on which there was a topic that you were really curious to know about, I think a really shitty way to pursue knowledge on that topic would be to come to a trampoline hall lecture. Like, I don't think a lot of people, like when we send out the invite to the lecture, the sort of top billing is like trampoline hall is happening. And then it's like, here's who chose the lectures. And then it's like, here's who the people are. And then it's like, what the topics are. Like you don't come to trampoline hall. Like if it was a real lecture series, you'd come because you'd be like, oh, I want to learn about, you know, whatever, genetics, and this is a lecture on
people
genetics.
Don't come for the topics, nor do they come for the names. They come for trampoline hall.
Yeah, you come for trampoline hall. Sometimes they come for the names. I mean, sometimes the people are interesting people, and you'd be like, oh, I want to hear what that guy says. But that's not the premise exactly either.
I guess you get like a benefit of it's a small venue. You got three speakers plus a curator. Each of those people has their people.
Yeah, so in terms of longevity, I mean, and this wasn't by design, but I think that one, when you named one thing that I think contributes to the longevity is just like so many people work on the show. And so many people come through the show. So there's a mechanism through which new people come through all the time. It's not just the same people coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that contributes to the longevity. And that certainly wasn't by design. That was by accident. And it wasn't even originally the case. Like we have, you know, originally Sheila Heady, who started the show, you know, did a lot of the work now that now lots of people do. And I think that in some ways, the fact that lots of people do that work serves to kind of broaden the community of who comes through the door in some way. So I think that's one thing that contributes to the longevity of the show. I also think it's a good show. I mean, I think that's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's a mixed bag as a show because some speakers are good and some speakers are bad.
Yeah.
But you're really good.
Well, the thing that I like to think is that the show – thank you. The thing that I like to think is it's a mixed bag in terms of whether the speakers are good or not good. But the thing that I like to think is that the show is designed in such a way that – that doesn't break the show. Like, it's part of the design of the show is that the speaker...
Because everyone knows that the lecture, if it's bad, will end pretty soon, and then you will come and interact
we'll
with the
Q&A.
Person. And sometimes the interaction between you and the audience and the speaker might be even more interesting if
Absolutely.
It was a flaming train wreck of a lecture.
Absolutely.
And you sort of are the proxy representative of the audience. You somehow represent that. And you do that without – I've only been a few times, and I've heard the first episode of the podcast. But you do that without mocking the speaker or degrading them in any way. And when I was there, I was impressed by your crowd work.
Sure.
Like I felt like you were very, very quick and very, very confident in that room. And I thought, oh, this guy's just he's a very good host.
Yeah.
And that suggests opportunities in a career that I have to imagine – I was not the first. I said, well, you know, at the time I was working for the CBC, and I said, do you have any interest in talking about making this a CBC show or something? And I was surprised by how kind of unenthused you were by that idea.
Yeah.
Which, like, the trajectory in media would be like, you start doing something at, like, a little club on the corner, and then you should be aspiring. And I guess that's something that I find I'm curious about with you, and not just in terms of Trampoline Hall. I wonder if there's some kind of resistance to the traditional aspirations or traditional trajectories of what a media career or a writing career might be. It seems like you either don't want those things. I don't know.
Right. So that's a good question. So again, it goes to your earlier question too about like what explains the longevity of Trampoline Halls. Because like one reason a show like that could stop happening is because it could fail. But the other reason a show like that could stop happening is because it could succeed, which is I think what basically happened with, say, Little Grey Books. Like I think the reason Little Grey Books stopped happening, I'm just totally guessing here, but might not be disconnected to the fact that John Hodgman became a very successful and famous person and didn't want to keep, you know, hosting a bar for 100 people. You know,
when he was like a massive Apple millionaire.
Yeah, and be like, but I'm going to like go back and host this show in a bar in Brooklyn.
I mean, that's a fair assumption. That's probably what killed the
Liberty. That like part of it is like, oh, it made him successful and so he could stop doing it. And so that's maybe one of the things that contributed to the success of Trampoline Hall was that we found ways to, I'm answering your last question now, is that we have found ways to make it something that not just the people want to keep coming to, but also that people want to keep working on.
Mm-hmm.
And
it has everyone been hosted by you?
Yeah. I have hosted every single show.
And have you missed a month?
Here's a shocking thing. We've never canceled a show. We've never started late. We've had one lecture cancel in 15 years. I'm not sure how we do that. But when you think about the longevity, like there's something about like the institutional design of the show that's like very robust. In a given year, the number of people who come together to make Trampoline Hall, right now that's the 30 or whatever people who lecture in a given year. It's the 10 people or so whose job it is to go out and find those lecturers. It's the people who set up the chairs. It's the people who work the door. It's the people who make the website, the people who make the tickets, people make the set. It's a different all of those people. The tickets are these art objects that you go and buy at Soundscapes at the record store. There's a handmade set that like a different artist makes every month. So like in a given year, it's like 50 more people who work on the show, and they all work for free. No one gets paid.
All credit there, but it also seems like that's a rotating cast of people, and the constant fixture is you.
Absolutely.
Which is something that I kind of connected to as a broadcaster. Like in creative circles, people are always moving from project to project, and it's one thing to have an idea.
Yeah.
But as a broadcaster, I've always felt like, and this is sort of a lesson that some people who mentored me taught, is like, you do this every week. You know, it's not some special objet d'art. You turn on the tap and cold water comes out.
Yeah.
On Monday morning, there should be a Canada Land.
Are you the water? What are you? This analogy. Oh, I say just be reliable. CBC is the thing in the world that most feels like a tap that you just turn on. And like
absolutely,
CBC
which
out,
I, th- I think
radio
FM radio itself
comes out of that tap.
It's longevity and why it's been resilient through so many challengers is it's got the best user interface.
It's actually literally like a tap, isn't it? It's like the same mechanism. You turn a knob.
Yeah.
And like if you turn the knob more, then more comes out. And if you turn the knob less, then less comes out. You know?
So, it seems like your commitment to it is...
I love doing it. And then part of it for me too is like, so for me, why I've kept doing it is... primarily because it's really fun for me, and I think I'm good at it too. Like it's fun. It's a fun thing that I'm good at. I enjoy doing it. I take great pleasure in doing it. And there is no similar thing. Like one of the things I thought earlier on was I was like, oh, like there was a point early on when Sheila was like, you know, maybe I'll, you know, Sheila quit, a few years in. And there was a time earlier when she thought she'd shut it down. And the thing I thought like more about like musicians and be like, oh, if you know your band breaks up, you go join, you know, you go play bass with another band. But for me, I'd be like, well, if Trampoline Hall breaks up, I'm going to find like another bar where I can stand up and host a Q&A for there's not a lot of opportunities to do that. I feel a lot of sympathy for people who are like talk show hosts.
Yeah.
Like it's like there really only are, I mean, maybe now a little bit more than there used to be, but there are not that many jobs in the world for talk show hosts. So like if you have one of those jobs and you like it, you're going to hold on to it really, really, really fucking tight.
Sure. And the interesting thing about those jobs is that these people are spoken of in the same circles as like these A-list celebrities.
Yeah.
But they're chained to, they have to do that every day. Yeah. Like, again, it's like a public utility.
Right. So that's the other thing. So with Trampoline Hall, the thing for me was like, I really like doing this. I like doing it for this audience in this way, in this context too. Like part of the thing for me with Trampoline Hall really early on was like, oh, I'm on stage. I'm doing this thing, which like brings together a whole bunch of things that I'm really good at and that I really like, which is not just... it's not like I'm doing stand-up. I'm doing this really specific thing where other people are giving talks and I'm helping an audience make sense of it in a way where I get to sort of make jokes, but my job isn't primarily to be funny. And I'm working for an audience who's on the whole pretty smart. Like it's a bookish kind of thing. I guess one of the things that I like about it too, I have to say, and this is an odd thing, is like I kind of like doing it once a month.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to a friend of mine who was a stand-up. He was describing why he did stand-up, and he was like, you know, he was like, to me, it is an addiction. Like, I do a show, and I love it, and it is the most fun thing in the world to me, and I get off stage, and what I think is, like, I want to be on stage again, like, now. And he's like, so I do, like, you know, as many shows a month as I can possibly do, and I get up on stage as much as I want, as I can, and, like, because there's nothing I would rather do than be on stage. And for me, it's like, I do Trampoline Hall, and I'm like, it's super fun. And then about 3 weeks later, I start to think, like, I'd like to do that again.
Right.
Like being on stage is intense, you know, and I say this
You have a manageable habit.
In some ways, I feel embarrassed because I feel like I should be more ambitious. But in another way, I actually kind of feel proud of that. Like, I feel like, oh, that's a healthy amount of spotlight to want. And I kind of wouldn't want my whole life to be like being on stage every single day and like interacting with the world the way you do when you're on stage and doing that all the time. It's not something I crave. And then the other thing too is that when there are offers to do something like that, the offer is something that through conversation that like you realize like, oh, it's not going to be as good. It's like, oh, we're going to do something that'll be just like Trampoline Hall. Oh, awesome, cool. Except there's not going to be a live audience. Well, now it's not just like Trampoline Hall. Or, oh, but here's the thing, you know, it's going to be, you have to only talk about things happening like in the news and Canadian culture and be like, well, I don't give a shit about talking things in the news and Canadian culture. That sounds really depressing and boring to me. So the idea that like there would be this thing that actually would be that satisfying.
Right.
And then I guess for me, there's lots of other stuff I like to do. So I think that's part of it for me too. Like there's actually a lot of things I like to do more. And so I wouldn't want it to be my whole life to be doing that.
So why turn it into a show now?
There's a bunch of reasons to turn it into a podcast. So one is doing a podcast doesn't change any of those variables for me. It's not like now that it's a Trampoline Hall podcast, I have to come and sit in a studio. Like people can listen to it every week, but I don't have to go into a studio every week to make that happen for them. We've been recording the shows for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this archive of shows. And what we'll do is we will take those shows and we will release them one at a time as podcasts. So the idea is that for me, it doesn't really create a lot of new work. It's just a way to take the work that we've already done and reach a broader audience with it. I guess one thing that's changed is it feels to me like we're now at the point in internet history where like keeping something offline feels like you're doing an active thing. Like in 2003, people would be like, well, why don't you put your show online? They'd be like, what do you mean? It's a show. Like it would be a lot of work to put it online. And
yeah,
there's lots of stuff in the world that isn't online and we're part of that thing. But now it almost feels like if the thing isn't online, it's like you're being precious and actively keeping it from being online. Which isn't how I want to feel. I'm like, you know.
So it's a passive gesture.
Yeah, well, it's more just like, okay, everything's online. I mean, I like the fact that everything's online.
Uh-huh.
You know, last time we thought about this seriously, we were thinking about it for radio. And I think it's before like podcasts really like blew up as a medium. And I think Trampoline Hall makes more sense as a podcast than it does as radio. So I think like as radio, when people be like, oh, we're going to make it radio. So here's an example of the change. I talked to folks at the CBC on a couple of occasions about doing Trampoline Hall as a podcast. And they're like, that's a great idea. But we'll do different lecturers. We'll get people who are like guaranteed to be really good speakers. And I was like, yeah, that's interesting, but that's absolutely not what Trampoline Hall is. But you can also understand why you wouldn't want to like, you know, use the public airwaves and the taxpayers' money to, you know, to broadcast to like, you know, the millions of people listen to the CBC, like someone who just bumbled in off stage and didn't want to. You know.
Yeah, but what you're doing now could just as easily be on the radio. You're going through the archives and using the ones that you like.
An editorial decision we made pretty early on was that the podcast is meant to be in some ways characteristic of what Trampoline Hall is like. So there will be train wrecks and there will be ones where like, oh, that didn't quite hit, but then it gets fixed in the Q&A or it doesn't get fixed in the Q&A. But it's not like we're just choosing the, you know, the top 10% or something like that, you know.
And this is a commercial project. You're doing this with a media company.
We're doing it with a media company. I don't think anyone thinks they're going to get rich off it.
Yeah.
Now the question is, you know, well, so we'll see. I mean, I think we'll see if it turns out to be a sustainable project in that way.
You're working with who? Sumo Media. Is that Cindy Witten's thing?
That is indeed, yes.
Okay, former CBC executive.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
So we're trying to figure out, you know, and Cindy's been like very supportive of it in terms of like, I think like in terms of the financial question, I think we're all kind of like, this is a bit of an experiment to see whether this can make money.
If we can kind of conceive of the suggested trajectory of a very successful lecture series and the resistance to taking that route, I almost kind of see a trend where reading this thing you wrote for the Paris Review about going to Harvard.
Right.
And what you wrote about is how you felt like you went there, did whatever you had to do to get in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Graduated.
Yeah.
Got into the Lampoon, which is competitive to go right for the Lampoon.
Yeah, sure.
Did not pursue a job in comedy.
No.
Did not pursue a career in law or in the American elite.
No. It is really easy to think that because some like prize in life is enviable, that it's desirable for you. And like, I mean, literally like enviable, like the kind of thing that people compete for or envy or whatever. So like a good example of that is like being a talk show host. Like there are many, many, many more people who would like to be talk show hosts than there are jobs for talk show hosts. Being a talk show, if you want to be a talk show host and you get to be a talk show host, then you've won. Like say, you know, being like the host of a show on a network, like you have won the fucking prize. That is it. That is an enviable thing. when you asked me, like, didn't people come to you with these jobs as radio? And I was like, oh, like, how flattering, like, that someone comes to you and says, like, hey, you should have your own show on the CBC. Let's think about you having your own show on the CBC. And you think, well, that seems very flattering, and that seems very enviable. But then I started to think about it, and I'm like, thought about how it would change my life and be like, well, you know, it would mean I couldn't do all these other things that I do now that I really like. I also thought about, like, people I knew who had jobs hosting radio shows. They didn't, you know, some of them seemed happy. A lot of them didn't. Like, if I talk, like, I knew enough people with those jobs that when I talked to them about it, a lot of them didn't seem like they liked their jobs as much as, I don't know, just a lot of other people I know, you know, who have jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they might feel, like, scared to lose their jobs because their jobs are so enviable and scarce and hard to have or whatever, but they didn't seem particularly happier in their work than other people. I'm kind of proud to have come to the conclusion that, like, oh, right, I really like doing a show in a bar once a month. I like exactly that much attention and prestige, yeah, and applause. And, like, if someone comes to me and says, Misha, we can give you 50 times as much attention and applause, I'm like, I actually think 50 times more attention and applause is not something that's going to make my life better.
Sure. I mean, that sounds like a very rational and, like, mature decision.
And just to be clear, it wasn't made as rationally and maturely as that. But
no, I don't know. It's you know, you're talking about calculations that I'm very familiar with, though I've made very different decisions. And, yeah, and I mean, part of it is you got to do something.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Know?
And just the need to pay your rent.
Yeah.
But if you had other things that were taking care of that.
Yeah, and I had other things to do. So there was always that balance between, like, would I rather be doing this or would I rather be doing the other things that I do? And there were always.
Yeah. You can talk yourself out of anything, though.
Sure, but a lot of the time you're right.
Right.
Maybe I was wrong. You know, I mean, maybe. I mean, the other explanation is that, you know, the stuff was too scary and I didn't want to do it. And it was, you know, the stakes were too high and I was too loss averse for whatever other kinds of things and stuff like that. But I don't think so.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, with a difference between the work you do and the work that I do is that Canada needs someone to be like an independent media critic and to do the work that,
sure,
you do. It's like work that's necessary. Like, if you weren't doing it, you might think, like, oh, man, it's a shame someone else should do that because that really needs to happen. With Trampoline Hall, I mean, I think it's a good show, but when I do Trampoline Hall, I don't have a sense that, like, oh, I have, like, put some good into the world in quite the same way. I mean, I think it's good. I think it's important. But, like, in other work that I do, again, like, not to, you know, when people come to my class and I teach them how to, like, get better at, like, coming to agreements with their coworkers or loved ones or whatever, I feel like, oh, I've like made the world a better place in a way that feels more palpable to me. And that's important for me too. So that's one of the reasons why that kind of full-time job doing something like Trampoline Hall didn't seem super fun to me. It was that it doesn't, not to say that that work isn't important, but it doesn't in my gut feel important in the same way,
yeah,
as stuff that has more direct application.
You don't feel like driven by a sense of purpose to.
Yeah, I don't feel driven by a sense of purpose to create art or entertainment in the way that maybe some people who do that work do, you know? I guess what I think is there are things that we want and then we get tricked a lot of the time by proxies for those things,
mm-hmm,
you know? So you think, like, oh, I want to feel good about myself. So what I'll do is I want to feel good about myself. I know that I feel shitty about myself when I see other people who are more conventionally successful than me. So what I'll try to do is I'll try to get a job like those people have. But if you think it through, you're like, oh, right, but that actually doesn't work. Like, you know, so you fixate on pursuing that job like those people have, then you get that job like those people have, but you still feel shitty about yourself. It doesn't actually fix the underlying problem, but you pursue the proxy goal of prestige, as an example, you know.
Yeah.
Money's like that too.
Well, I think that, you know, there's something kind of privileged about even being able to have these kinds of, to have the space to say, well, what is the perfect?
I disagree. I think everyone should feel weird about their Harvard experience, you know, no matter what social class they come from. I don't see how it has anything to do with privilege.
You know, I have this deep ambivalence about...
Or about their radio show.
Sure.
Or about their podcast.
Yeah.
Or about the bar, the show that they host in a bar. I mean, when you're talking about questions like, you know, why do you turn down a job at, you know, why did you not pursue a career in media? That's a question between two people who have, in the grand sense of things, quite a lot of privilege. I mean, it'd be very different if I was, you know, cleaning rooms in a hotel. And that seemed to me like the outcome I was looking at in my life when someone said, hey, do you want to host a show on the CBC? I would say, yes, I would rather host a show on the CBC than clean rooms in a hotel.
Yeah.
But I'm not.
On one hand, I feel like what a wonderful creative act to be able to pursue your interests and build a life for yourself that is outside of these established, like, grooves of how you're supposed to work your way up these various hierarchies, and you're supposed to buy into the idea that the payoff will be satisfying.
Yeah.
You can achieve a life where you are both sustaining yourself financially and you know, you've got a family, you got a kid now. You can be praised for this book you did with Sheila in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. You could write a thing for the Paris Review. You can even get those, for as much as it's a critique,
yeah,
of prestige, you've got a lot of the kind of trophies of prestige,
yeah.
And yet be bound by none of the entrapments. I mean, it's a very modern thing too, to be able to kind of design your life and career.
Portfolio careers, I think they call it.
Yeah.
One reason I keep doing the show is because people keep coming.
Yeah.
Like, that's an engagement with the world. Like, I've done lots of other things where people don't keep coming. I don't do them. I have had an unhealthy, I think, lifelong resistance to, like, being at the bottom and starting and working my way up in anything. And so one thing that I've often done is I found things to do where I can kind of come in through the side door. Mm-hmm. So like with Trampoline Hall, the first day I walked on stage and hosted Trampoline Hall, I was the best Trampoline Hall host in the world. I think in some ways it probably does actually come out of like a kind of cowardice or whatever. Like, we're just like, I don't want to suffer that indignity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the desire to not suffer that indignity leads to interesting things because it forces you to come up with new solutions. Like, if there's a thing that, you know, 1,000 people are trying to be good at, why would I want to go and do that? Just even in terms of what the world needs. Like, does the world really need one more person trying to be good at that thing that 1,000 people are already trying to do?
That's a really interesting
Or does
point.
The world need people to go and try something really new? There's clearly no shortage of opportunity to do new stuff.
All right. So everybody listen to Misha's podcast. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
That's your Canada Land show. I hope you enjoyed it. Email me anytime. I'll read what you send me. I'll respond when I can. I am at jesse@canadalandshow.com. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/canadaland. New episode of The Imposter going up on Wednesday. Next episode of Shortcuts on Thursday. I make this show with Katie Jensen. Russell Gregg handles syndication to radio stations across this country. If you like what we do, please support us. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.